Okay, let me ask if anyone has any questions from before the break. Is it clear why, when there are shortages, increases in supply will not reduce price? And how the allocation of supplies among geographical markets and factors of production among their various possible products, why that becomes largely indeterminate and can swing on the basis of small changes, why supply is so unstable. Okay, well then, assuming that all of that is perfectly clear, let's turn to the spillover of demand that results from shortages. When people are in a situation that they can't obtain the goods they want to obtain because a shortage exists, they're not allowed to spend their money in bidding up the price of the things in a state of shortage and thus ending the shortage. They're not going to sit for very long just with unspendable money. They might increase their cash holdings somewhat, but in a period of inflation in which the quantity of money is continually increasing at a rapid rate, pretty soon cash holdings are more than adequate, and people will start to spend on other goods that were not their first choices, but which are still available. And if these other goods are uncontrolled, if we have price controls on some goods only, not on everything, and people would like to be able to spend more money on the controlled goods, but are prohibited by the controls from doing so. After all, there are only certain quantities available, and if the prices are controlled on limited quantities, that implies a limited amount of money that you can spend on those things. And if people have the ability to spend more money than that, well, money that they otherwise would have spent on the controlled goods, if they were uncontrolled, they will then spend on other goods. And as they do so, what is the effect on the demand for other goods, on their prices, and the profitability of producing them? Yes, Mr. Timotek?
Prices increase.
Okay, the prices of the uncontrolled goods will tend to increase. They're in greater demand. Their prices are not controlled. And what happens to the profitability of producing the uncontrolled goods?
It's greater.
Pardon me?
It's greater.
The uncontrolled goods, their profitability goes up. That's where people are able to spend. That's what they're able to buy. And what will this do to where capital is invested and what will be produced in the economy as far as possible?
Decrease capital available to the controlled industry.
I mean, the capital invested in the controlled industries will be cut back because it's more profitable to use it in the uncontrolled industries. The goods produced in the uncontrolled industries will tend to expand, and the production of the controlled industries will contract. Now, which kinds of industries do you think the government would single out for price controls? Industries that it considers relatively unimportant and trivial, or industries that it considers vital and of enormous importance?
Vital.
The vital industries, those are the ones it controls. Now, what's its motive in controlling the production of the prices of the vital goods? Pardon me?
Importance, right? You're asking about the...
Yeah, why would they be inclined to put price controls on the goods they consider important?
To make them available to everybody.
They want to make them available. They want them to be affordable by everybody, and they want everybody to have access to them. But what is accomplished when you have a situation where the profitability of the controlled goods declines relative to the profitability of the uncontrolled goods? Does the government achieve its purpose?
No.
No, it serves, its controls end up reducing the supply of the controlled goods and enlarging the supply of those goods the government considers too unimportant, at least for the time being, to be brought under price controls. Now, it would actually be more effective means to maintain or enlarge the supply of goods that considers the government considers vital, if they left the vital industries free of controls and put the controls on the unimportant industries. Then they'd be bringing about an increase in the production of the important goods, or the ones they considered important, at the expense of the ones they considered unimportant. But the government doesn't know that, and so it adopts a policy that is contrary to its own purpose. Its purpose is to make the goods available, accessible, and it makes them less available. And it doesn't even succeed in keeping prices overall down, because what happens to the prices of the uncontrolled goods? They go up, so prices will be higher, not on the controlled goods, but the uncontrolled goods. And an implication is that partial price controls don't restrain the general price level. That's point B. Partial price controls cannot hold down the general price level. They also, point C, don't save people money in the aggregate. People spend less in buying the things they want, and they end up spending that much more in buying things they consider less important. There is no overall saving of money, just a misdirection of the spending. And what is the effect to the extent that price controls on some goods served to disrupt the supply of vital materials? Like, suppose we had just price controls on oil and oil products. What would be the effect of that on our overall ability to produce, given that it means we'll have a smaller supply of oil?
Capital.
I know Mr. Zink says it lowers it. Does anyone else have an opinion? Pardon me?
No, there's only one other option. So.
Well, you might say it raises production, but if there's less oil, oil is a critical element in production. We need oil to transport practically everything, to provide heat. It's also used extensively in the generation of electricity. It's a fuel for power plants. If we have less oil and less electric power, what has to be the effect on our ability to produce? That will almost certainly be less. And to the extent that it does undercut our ability to produce, and we have smaller supplies of goods than we otherwise would have, what's the effect on prices coming as the result of a smaller supply of goods? That would be higher. So the paradoxical effect of partial price controls, to the extent they disrupt the supply of important materials, is actually to make the general price level higher. And by the same token, repeal of such controls, which would restore the supply of these vital means of production, would operate to reduce the general price level. Now, I have a special application to rent controls. And I just want to deal with how it is that this point, how partial rent controls, that is, rent controls on part of the supply of rental housing, but not its totality, how rent controls on a portion of the supply of rental housing serve to raise rents on the portion of the supply that remains uncontrolled. In fact, this will apply to any good in a situation in which only part of its supply is controlled and another part is left uncontrolled. The effect of any such partial price control is to raise the price on the portion of the supply that remains free of control.
Is that analogous to the power supply issue?
Pardon me?
Was that analogous to the power supply in California?
I would think it has application. I'm not as immediately clear on how to apply it. I can apply it more easily to oil and certainly to rent control. It would apply to electric power, too. There was a time a few summers back in this process of alleged deregulation, which somehow never deregulated the retail price of power in most jurisdictions, only deregulated the wholesale price. Well, I guess that's a good illustration. Do we have a discussion of that?
And I just thought that that was what it applied to as well.
Well, it would apply to that in a different way, in a somewhat different way. Pardon me?
We talked about that in our class.
We did.
In my class on Wednesday.
Oh, on Wednesday, right. Okay, I'm sorry, I thought you, I didn't recognize that you were simply from Wednesday. Okay, we discussed it in Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I don't think we did here. Thank you for reminding me. Okay. Now, what was controlled for the most part was the retail price of power, but not the wholesale price. And the wholesale price was going through the roof. And that happened because the power companies have the obligation to meet the quantity of power demanded by their customers until they reach the absolute limit of safety in supplying it. If the grid is about to short circuit, well then they can cut people off, impose blackouts or brownouts. But short of that, they're obliged to supply as much as they can. And they have to do it at a controlled price. Now, what is the effect of the low controlled price on the quantity of power demanded? It's greater, right? And the power companies are obliged to scurry for this power, get it wherever they can, and buy it irrespective of the cost. Well, what do you think happens to the prices they have to pay if they're running out of sources of supply? The prices can get to be immensely high. Now, why would the price of power at wholesale have been much lower if the price at retail had been allowed to go higher?
Demand would have decreased.
The quantity demanded at the retail level would have been less, and then the quantity of power that the distributors needed to obtain at the wholesale level would have been less, and they could have gotten power at the wholesale level at a lower price. They wouldn't have had to get it from every last nook and cranny. So when you have the price artificially low to the consumers, but the producers are legally compelled to supply it, that serves to drive up the price at the producer level. Have a higher price at the retail level, that reduces quantity demanded at the retail level, reduces the quantity the distributors need to buy, and they can buy the smaller quantity at a lower price. So this is a good way that the power situation illustrates the point. And we had, there were other ways the situation would be illustrative, but let me turn to partial rent controls and then the case of oil. Let's suppose we have two units, to make it as simple as possible. We'll assume we have two units of rental housing, but we have three potential bidders. We have three bidders for the two units. We have Brandon, Decky, and Jim, and they're all three bidders for these two units of rental housing. Brandon is able and willing to pay $3,000 a month for his apartment. Decky is able and willing to pay $2,000 a month for his apartment. Jim is able and willing to pay $1,000 a month for his apartment. Now, in a free market, where would the apartment rent tend to settle?
Higher.
It has to be low enough to make possible the sale of the rental of the two units, so it has to be below Decky's $2,000. To limit the quantity demanded to the two units, it has to be above Jim's $1,000. So let's say it'll be $1,500 in the middle. So in the free market, the rent of these two units is $1,500. Okay, now suppose Jim starts moaning and groaning and whining. He can't find an apartment. He needs an apartment. He's got to have a place that he can afford. And he lives in California, and he gets a proposition on the ballot, and hordes of ignorant voters vote for his proposition, and they will give him an apartment at a price below $1,000. So this apartment now goes to Jim at the rent he can afford, say $500 a month. Okay, because Jim is occupying this apartment at a below market rent, what has happened to the supply available for the uncontrolled market? It's now one unit instead of two. And now we still have two bidders. We have Decky and Brandon. And where is the rent going to be on this one uncontrolled unit? It's got to be higher than Decky's 2,000, still below Brandon's 3,000. So now it may settle at 2,500. Now this result should not be so surprising. What we've done by virtue of the partial price control is effectively reduced the market supply. You see, it's not that there are fewer units in existence, but there are fewer units available for supply on the market because we've given one of the units to a submarginal buyer. We've given it to someone who wouldn't have been in the market, and now that reduces the supply available for the market. It's equivalent to a reduction in supply on the market. We've taken a unit off the market, given it to a submarginal buyer. So now the supply that remains on the market is scarcer and more expensive. And in this way, partial rent controls drive up the rents on whatever part of the supply remains uncontrolled. And paradoxically, that serves to perpetuate the rent controls. In a place like New York City, where most of the housing is under one form of rent control or another, but there is still some little bit of rental housing. I think the rental housing constructed after 1973, you see, if you want any new housing constructed, you have to make the new housing free of the controls. Otherwise, there just won't be any new housing. So it's typically the older existing housing that's under the controls. So the supply of housing that's free of the controls is pretty small. And what this means is that anyone who wants to obtain rental housing, the only place they can obtain it in the open market is on a very limited part of the overall supply. The supply is artificially reduced on the open market, and so the rents on the open market are stupendous. The rents are huge. And then people look at these enormous rents and they think, well, my God, if we repealed rent control, nobody could afford to live in an apartment. No one could just afford it because all the rents would be astronomical. Well, that's like saying, if here we are, we have this one unit available and it's going for 2,500, that we don't dare abolish rent control because then all the rents will be 2,500. Is that true? What would be the effect of abolishing the rent control on this part of the supply? As soon as it goes above 1,000, it's too expensive for Jim, but then it's offered on the market, and who's it got to be rented to? To Decky, at a rent he can afford. He can pay more than Jim, but it still has to be less than his maximum. So the rent will go up from 500 to 1,500, and now we have a market supply, the price of which is 1,500, and that's going to enable Brandon no longer to have to pay 2,500. He'll be able to get a rent at 1,500. Because we're enlarging the supply available for the market. In a way, this is analogous, I think, to the example of, in physics, if you're spraying water out of your hose, if you leave the hose wide open, well, the water comes out with a certain pressure. But the more you block the opening, the greater and more powerful is the stream of water that comes from the narrower opening. Well, that's analogous to the higher are the rents, the more restricted is the supply available for the market by virtue of taking chunks of the supply and renting them below market rents. Now, this very same example has great application to the price controls on oil. When we had price controls on oil, they were partial price controls. They could only apply to oil produced within the United States. We had no power to control the price of oil in Europe or Japan or elsewhere. And so the price there was much higher. Now, if here we are, we have there's two units of supply, and one of them is the supply produced in the United States, the other is the supply produced in the world market. Normally, in a free market, they'd sell at the same price. But let's say we're giving one of these units to submarginal buyers, we're controlling the domestic price, enabling people to buy oil who couldn't have bought as much had the price been uncontrolled. So we're taking a big chunk of the domestically produced oil and giving it to Jim. The oil that we can't control is the oil produced outside the United States, largely by OPEC and our good friends, the Arab sheiks. So what will be the effect when we give the oil, the domestically produced oil, at a low price to Jim? What are we doing to the world price of oil? Because where will the competition now turn for the limited supply that remains on the market? From the Arab suppliers. So this unit is the unit produced by the Arabs, and that goes at a price determined by the competition of a narrower number of bidders. Because we're giving the domestic output to sub-marginal buyers to an important degree, reducing the supply available for the market. Now, the implication is that when we repeal the control, even before there is any increase in the production of oil, before there's any increase in the production of oil, just by getting the sub-marginal buyers out of the market, by making it too expensive for them, what are we doing to the supply, the portion of what is produced that is now available for the normal market? What are we doing to the market supply? Yes? We're increasing it. And so what you'd expect to happen to the market price? It'll go down. You repeal the control, the price on the open market goes down. And that's what actually happened. People with minimal understanding of economics, such as most of the press and the many people in the Congress, they were terrified of repealing the controls because they thought prices will just remain through the limit. They wanted to postpone the repeal indefinitely. But no sooner was there a repeal than prices started declining. Yes, Mr. Cooper.
In a free market, what stops a monopoly company to artificially control the supply and pump up the prices?
In a free market, what stops a company from getting control of the entire supply and charging a higher price? Well, in a few not very important cases, this may happen. In diamonds, maybe mercury, a couple of other minerals, if something is found in very, very few places, and it's possible for one company or one combination of companies to get the whole supply, well, they are in a position to produce somewhat less and get a higher price. So that could happen. But there's no shortage of their product, there's just a higher price, and somewhat less is available. Now, with all of the fears and complaints we have about the scarcity of natural resources, in such cases one could look at this as a kind of conservation measure. The supplies will be available, but they're just getting extracted more slowly. Now, I would say more typically, it's the case that things are available from a potentially wide range of sources. And if you want to be the sole supplier of something that could be produced potentially by many others, then the only way to guarantee your ability to be the sole supplier is to offer your item at a price that is lower than what others would need to be profitable. So if you want to be the sole supplier in a situation in which something is available from others, at least potentially, in order to remain the sole supplier, you would have to offer what you're producing at a price below what would be required to make them profitable. And in that case, you'd achieve your position of sole supplier on the basis of lower prices, not be able to use it as the basis of higher prices. Okay, let's turn to this point G, the tendency toward universal price controls. It's not an inexorable tendency, but it is the case that there is a powerful impetus starting with partial price controls. It should not at all be surprising to see partial price controls blossom into total or universal price controls on everything. Now, why is that the case? Well, if you start off with one price control, I'll use the example Mises used to use. Suppose we begin with a price control on one good, let's say milk. And we have this price control because the government is concerned that poor families are unable to afford milk, and it wants to make milk affordable. So it imposes a control, it limits the price of milk. All right, if milk is now made low enough in price so that all the poor families can supposedly afford all that they wish of it, what will this be doing to the profitability of supplying milk?
Reduce it.
And so we would easily end up with less milk than we had before and a worse supply, and the government's purpose would immediately be defeated. Well, if the government wants, in fact, to have the supply of milk maintained at the lower price, it's insufficient for it simply to have a price control on milk at the retail level. It has to do something further, because otherwise the supply will just disappear. Now, one possible thing it could do is subsidize the sale of milk. It could say, okay, we understand that for the sale of milk to yield a competitive rate of profit, the price that we're allowing is insufficient. We want you sellers to keep the price where we've set it, and we, the government, will make up the difference in the form of a subsidy. So if we're compelling you to sell milk for $1 a carton and you would need $2 a carton, keep selling at $1 a carton and we'll pay you an extra dollar for every carton that you sell. We'll give you a subsidy. Okay, in that case, you could have the low price of milk, the low controlled price maintained. The government would be paying a subsidy sufficient to guarantee the profitability of the production of milk. And they could have a subsidy on a quantity that would meet the quantity demanded at the price of a dollar. So this could be feasible. But suppose the government can't afford the subsidy or just doesn't want to pay it, and they don't want to repeal the price control. Well, then what would they have to do?
Control the prices that constitute the other costs of production.
They control the prices that constitute the costs of milk at retail. They'd have to control the wholesale price. Like the next step in the electric power situation, it was sort of surprising. They were controlling the retail price. The wholesale price was going through the roof, bankrupting Pacific Gas and Electric, almost bankrupting Southern California Edison. The logical thing would have been, if they didn't abolish the retail control, to impose price controls at wholesale. I guess they actually got to that. It's unclear what's happened since. But in any case, the logic, starting with one control, if you can't back it with subsidies, is that you then have to carry controls further and control the prices that constitute the costs of the thing that you're originally controlling so that its production will be profitable at the controlled price you've imposed. All right, let's say the government has done that. It's controlling the price of milk at the wholesale level. Well, now what problem comes up? Can they simply stop with a price control on the wholesale price of milk?
Yeah.
Why not? That has to be profitable too, and if it's not, then the government has to go further and control the prices that constitute the cost of milk at wholesale. That means the price of milk to the dairy farmers, and then they have to control the prices that constitute the cost of the dairy farmers. They have to control the other prices that constitute the cost of distributing milk, the price of the cartons, the wages of the milk truck drivers, whatever may be involved. They have to control the array of prices that constitute the cost of providing this item. Well, where does this stop? Suppose they're at the level of controlling the price, the wages of the milk truck drivers and the wages of dairy farm workers. Can they stop there?
No.
Why not?
Because believe, you know, very common to the other industries.
Yeah, if their wages are controlled, while inflation is raising other wages in the economic system, in jobs that some of these workers can perform, well then the effect of the control will be to cause the supply of labor, where it's controlled, to diminish. And also, if you're causing the profits at any point to be below normal, you have to keep extending the controls further back. Once you're into wage controls, if you don't want the workers to leave where you've instituted the controls, what further measures do you have to adopt? Pardon me?
Something tied to the salary.
Well, you have to start controlling the wage rates in other lines into which these workers might go. So you're extending the process. Now, let's say you've reached the point where you're controlling the price of milk at retail, at wholesale, at the dairy level. What happens if you're leaving uncontrolled the prices of things like butter, cheese, and ice cream? Pardon me?
More of those are going to be made.
Then maybe the use of raw milk to produce those things becomes comparatively profitable, and that'll be cutting the supply of milk for drinking. So what do you have to do to stop that? They have to control those prices. So there are different things going on. Starting with any one price, there is a tendency to control prices further and further back in the chain of production, and to extend the controls sideways to other occupations into which the same labor might move, to other products of the same factors of production. And on this basis, the price controls tend to become universal. And the same point is brought out in the discussion we had a little before the break, where you have price controls on some industries, the vital goods, but you leave the unimportant goods uncontrolled. Well, that encourages the production of the uncontrolled goods, the relatively unimportant goods, the so-called ashtray industries. So what do you have to do to stop the expansion of the production of the relatively unimportant goods that have been left free of control up to now? Then we have a situation, yes?
You
have to put controls on them. You end up with controls on everything. So price controls starting out on one or a few goods have the potential very easily to spread to price controls throughout the economic system. And that's what I mean by universal price controls. When you have price controls just on some goods, isolated price controls, those are partial price controls. If you have price controls on a portion of the supply of a given good, that's a partial price control in an even more restricted sense. In contrast, there's price controls on everything. That's universal price controls. That's the system we had in World War II. Now, let's turn to a consideration of universal price controls. Because as we'll see, universal price controls are essentially the same in their basic nature as socialism. A good way to understand socialism is in terms of an economic system suffering from universal price controls. In both cases, the profit motive and the price system are paralyzed. Universal price controls and socialism have in common that they destroy the same thing. They both destroy the same basic element, and that is private property rights and the functioning of the profit motive. Socialism is out to destroy private property rights very openly, nakedly, explicitly. Socialism wants to confiscate all of the privately owned means of production. It wants the state to own all of the means of production and abolish private ownership. Well, as we'll see, universal price controls represent the same essential thing. For one thing, looking at it at one level, when you control the prices at which a business firm can sell, and the prices that it must pay for its inputs, well, you're controlling whether or not the firm can exist or must perish. If you're interfering with the freedom of a firm to buy and sell, you're interfering with its very ability to exist. You're acting at the very heart of private property rights. But we can see it in further ways. And let's look at what went on in the oil shortage, which and we can understand some of that on the basis of the chaos we've seen following. Suppose we have a situation under price controls and shortages where there are some markets that have little or no shortage, there are others that have dreadfully severe shortages. Some products of factors of production are in minimal or no shortage, others are in a very severe shortage. And it can be reversed. We could have a situation where the winter is coming, not enough heating oil is being produced, because for whatever reason, oil is being excessively allocated to gasoline. And we have some areas where there's simply not enough fuel available. We have this chaos. Do you think the government is just going to sit by and say, well, too bad, we've done as much as we can, and this is the end of the story? What do they do? What were they about to do when we had the situation? People who get to the stores early, they can be supplied. The latecomers go away empty-handed.
Odd-even days.
Odd-even days, and then they're about to have more formal rationing. What do you think the government would likely be doing if it sees that, well, look, the refineries are not turning out enough heating oil. Winter is coming. Or certain areas don't have gasoline, and people are just unable to drive their cars. Or the buses can't run because they lack fuel. Or the planes can't fly because they lack fuel. Or factories can't operate because they don't have fuel. Or the plastics industry can't function because it's missing some petrochemicals. Do you think the government is simply going to say, well, tough luck?
It's
going to
try and control it.
Yeah, the government will step in and tell the producers what products to produce, in what quantities, by what methods, and where to send the output. When you have general shortages and the market is paralyzed, the price system is paralyzed by the controls and the shortages, then the government steps in and takes control over the decision of what is produced, how it's produced, and what's done with the product. And this is how the Department of Energy came into being. We didn't have a Department of Energy before the price controls on oil and then the following oil crisis. And the way it got started was with something called the Federal Energy Administration. I forget if it was Federal Energy Administration or Federal Energy Agency, the FEA. And it was brought into being to cope with the chaos in connection with the distribution of supplies of oil and oil products geographically and in terms of what products the refineries produced. And so the Federal Energy Agency was created to step in and tell the refineries if they're producing too little heating oil, they must step up their production of heating oil. It took control of what they could produce, in what quantities, by what methods, and then which industries were to be supplied to what extent. So we had regulations. The airlines would get 80% of the jet fuel they had gotten the year before, then 90%. How much would be available for buses? How much for farmers to operate their tractors? How much would be available for trucks? How much for passenger automobiles? The government was making all these decisions. When the government steps in to do this, and under universal price controls, it will do it with everything. And it the methods of production have become a matter of concern too. You can see this already in the oil shortage. When there's a shortage of oil, it starts to matter to the government whether electric utilities are using oil or coal as their fuel. Now, shortly before the oil crisis, the government had been pushing the utilities away from coal to oil. When the oil crisis came, it started pushing them back the other way. If we had general shortages of materials, if we had a shortage of steel and aluminum and one thing and another, the government would be specifying what methods of production had to be used to save aluminum or steel or whatever it might be. The government interfering with thermostat settings is an indication. When you have, and that's going on to some degree today, we have intermittent shortages of electricity, or threatening intermittent shortages, as the result of a combination of rate controls on power, and so the quantity demanded is not limited very well, and we've had a policy of preventing the construction of sufficient power plants, so the supply can't keep up with the demand. And any time the quantity demanded reaches the limit, people are using their air conditioners, this threatens to blow the system, so the government is constantly urging people, cut back on your power usage. Set the thermostat on your air conditioner to 78 rather than 75 or 72. And in the winter, in the oil shortage, they wanted people to set their thermostat at 68. So these are interferences with the use that's made of the products and the methods of accomplishing results. I will just think for a moment, if the government is telling you not only what prices to charge, what prices to pay for your means of production, but also what to produce in what quantities and by what methods. How does this differ from the government being the effective owner of your means of production? So what do we mean by ownership? What distinguishes an owner of means of production from a non-owner? Okay, the owner decides what you do. The owner decides how his means of production are used, what will be produced, by what methods, in what quantities, and who's to get the product. Those, and at what prices the product will be sold. These are essential attributes of ownership. Now, if the government makes all these decisions, if it's setting your prices, telling you what to produce, in what quantity, by what methods, how to distribute it, then the government is the de facto owner, the owner of the means of production in fact. In outward guise and appearance, you still have private ownership of the means of production, but the private ownership is without substance. The government is the real de facto owner. And this was one of the great insights of my mentor Mises, that he identified this as effectively socialism. He realized that price controls and the shortages they caused, and then the further government controls to cope with the chaos of the shortages, that this was, in effect, a system of socialism. And he distinguished between two patterns of socialism. There's the obvious pattern that he called the Russian or Bolshevik pattern. There, the government openly nationalizes everything, and you have no doubt about who the owner is. But then there is another pattern, which is not so obvious, because the outward guise and appearance of private ownership of the means of production is maintained. If you go to City Hall and you ask, well, who owns the factory I saw outside of town, you'll find that there's a deed in the name of some private corporation, and on the books of the City Hall, the private corporation appears as the owner. But if that corporation has no power over the prices of its products or what it will pay for the means of producing them, no power to decide what it produces, in what quantities, by what methods, who will get the output, if all of those things are decided by the government, then the real owner of that factory is the government. Now, it may be that the stockholders of the corporation are allowed to receive dividends, but the government decides what dividends they receive. It may be that the management of the corporation receives high salaries to the extent the government approves them, but it's the government that's deciding what everyone gets. And the stockholders are in an actual position no different than that of other government pensioners. They're just getting more generous government pensions. Now, Mises, this arrangement was most prominently identified with Germany, going back to World War I. It was first introduced in World War I Germany and was run by the then quartermaster general of Germany, a man named Ludendorff. And then, not many years later, when the Nazis came to power in 1933, they reinstituted the same system of universal price controls and total government control over production. You had the nominal appearance of private ownership, but the decision as to what all of the nominally privately owned firms produced, in what quantities, by what methods, and what was done with the output, that was determined by the German government. So Mises calls this socialism on the German or Nazi pattern, in contrast to socialism on the Russian or Bolshevik pattern. But it's still socialism. The government is the actual owner of the means of production. Yes, Mr. Levin.
Can you give other examples aside from Germany?
Yeah, this sort of socialism existed in all, virtually all the countries engaged in World War II for the duration of the war. In the countries fighting Germany also, even in the United States, we had universal price controls. With the universal price controls, there were universal shortages. The foundation was there for total, utter economic chaos. As we'll see, when you have universal price controls and universal shortages, there is a new major dimension of chaos that we haven't yet seen, and that is a general shortage of labor and capital, such that the production of anything is capable of expanding at the expense of the production of anything else. It is possible, when there are general shortages, for the production of the most minor and trivial goods to expand at the expense of the most vital and urgent goods. And in order to prevent that, the government takes the power to tell every industry what it can produce, in what quantity, by what methods, and to flat out prohibit the production of certain things. Now, how does this happen? Well, a couple of things we have to look at, starting with excess demand under universal price controls. The extent of the excess demand, the extent of the shortages, is immensely more severe than if you have an isolated price control or a handful of price controls. Because what do people do when they find they can no longer obtain the goods that are in a state of shortage? What are they ready to buy? Other goods that are available. So if you got adjusted to not being able to buy all of the gasoline you wanted, well, that doesn't mean that you'll swallow the money that you would have spent on gasoline had you been able to buy it. You'll find an alternative use for that money. This is the spillover of demand effect that we've actually already discussed. So the effect of there being a shortage of things like gasoline is that the demand for other things that are not in a state of shortage, that will increase. Suppose we have a shortage of television sets. You'd like a new television set, but you can't find one. There's a shortage of them. Well, is there anything else you're interested in buying? Do you have a second choice for the money that you would have spent to buy a television set?
Sure.
Okay, there's something. Let's say it'll be a new suit or whatever. Now, so there's a rise in demand for that. Suppose there's a shortage of new suits also. Is there a third choice?
Absolutely.
And there's some third choice. Maybe that's a new refrigerator, who knows? The point is that what happens when you have general shortages, the excess unsatisfied demand confronting each individual good is also ready to spill over and compound the shortages of everything else. If you can find your second choice good, you'll snap that up. If you can't find the second choice good, you'll snap up the third choice. What happens is the excess demands for all of the different individual goods come to bear on the demand for each and every good. It's not just that we have people whose first choice is a new TV, they can't obtain the new TV, so they buy something else. There are also people who can't obtain a new refrigerator. They become willing to buy a new TV. But people who can't buy the new TV, they're willing to buy a new refrigerator. And we have the excess demands for everything bearing on the demand for everything. We have the excess demands for everything bearing on the demand for each thing. So there's an insatiable shortage of everything. And what this translates into is the kind of symptoms observed in Soviet Russia. In Soviet Russia, they had universal shortages. That was their normal situation. And in such conditions, people would carry around the clothing sizes of all their friends and relatives. They'd have a list of these things. They'd carry huge quantities of cash on the chance that when they were in downtown Moscow, maybe that particular day, their main department store might have supplies of new clothing in. And then people would race to snap them up. Or the grocery outlet might have toilet paper. They'd snap that up. They're willing to snap up everything. The only things that wouldn't be snapped up were goods of negative utility. For example, pots that would destroy the taste of the food cooked in them. They weren't selling. Or clothing that would shrink out of all relation to its original size. That didn't sell very well. But anything else would be snapped up immediately. It was at the point where when people saw a line forming, they would automatically get on it on the assumption that there is something worth getting. That's why people are getting in line. Something is available today that's worth getting. So they're ready to buy it. That is the kind of shortages you have when you have universal shortages. It was typical for people to spend 8 or 10 hours a week waiting in line to buy groceries. Now, when you have shortages of this kind, you can have practically any expansion of production and people will buy the product. Now let me explain how shortages come about. Even though all incomes are controlled, you might wonder, if people's wages are controlled, how are they getting the money to demand more and more of everything? Well, that's not so difficult to explain. Let's suppose the regular economy is putting 10 units of money into the hands of the ordinary citizens. So the ordinary citizens are getting 10 units of money. And the goods available to them, there's a certain quantity of goods available at controlled prices. And possibly the 10 units of money would be sufficient to buy the goods available at the controlled prices. All right, now suppose the government steps in and it spends 1 unit of money, which is newly created, and it gets goods for its 1 unit of money. So we have 10 units of money in the possession of the citizens, 1 unit of money in the hands of the government. The government gets a supply for its 1 unit of money. How much will the people be able to succeed in spending? The total supply of goods is at the controlled prices times the quantities available that would be bought for 10 units of money. The people have 10 units. But the government spends 1 unit that it creates. Now, how much can the people spend on the goods that are left? 9 units of money. The government, in effect, has bumped 1 unit of their spending. So the people have 1 unit of unspendable funds. The sellers take in 10 units of money. The sellers are in a position to pay out 10 units of money again. The citizens can again get 10 units of income. But suppose the government repeats this process. Well, what's happening to the funds in the possession of the citizens? The surplus unspendable funds as the result of the government's injection of new funds. There are more surplus unspendable funds backing up on the citizens. And this is how the demand can keep growing even though the incomes of the citizens are controlled. It's exactly this process. And this is what I refer to as the buildup of surplus unspendable income resulting from the government's injections of new money. Now, I want to turn to this major topic, universal price controls and the destruction of production through shortages. The destruction of production through shortages. And we have a review here of the ways that shortages destroy production. And I ask you in this review to keep in mind that anything that acts to raise costs of production implies a decline in production. Anything that implies more costs means either that it takes more labor to accomplish a given result and less labor is available for other things, or it takes more valuable materials, more valuable scarce materials, instead of less valuable scarce materials, leaving a lesser supply of important materials than would have been the case. Okay, we've seen that shortages make buyers impotent and thereby remove the incentives of sellers to provide good quality and service. And as a result, quality and service decline and the cost of maintenance and replacement increase. That's one way. Shortages of means of production, such as a material, often force sellers to reduce quality and service and make it necessary to resort to more expensive substitute methods of production. Shortages encourage sellers to concentrate on the production of unnecessarily expensive models as a disguised way of raising prices. They create a positive incentive to using more expensive methods of production if the government allows the pass-through of higher costs and makes the incurrence of higher costs a source of higher profits. They result in delays in production. They cause hoarding and the construction of additional storage facilities. They cause the waste of time in searching for supplies. And we saw they create chaos in the geographical distribution of a good among local markets, like gasoline during the oil shortage. And they create chaos in the destruction of a factor of production among its various uses in production. Example, crude oil in the production of the various oil products. Well, now we turn to universal price controls and universal shortages, and the problems are much worse. First, there's this compounding of the unsatisfied demand from everything bearing on everything. The unsatisfied demand for the television sets, the refrigerators, both bear on washing machines. The unsatisfied demand for washing machines and televisions comes back to bear on refrigerators. The unsatisfied demand for each thing bears down as an additional excess demand for everything else. So that increases the severity of the shortage. And then you have shortages of all of the means of production. You don't not only have shortages of the products you're producing, you have shortages of practically everything you're using to produce the products with. And then there's this new dimension of chaos that I refer to, the shortage of capital and labor. I say as point three, a total chaos in production, the expansion of any product at the expense of any other product, irrespective of the will of the consumers. And then we'll see how production declines in such conditions. All right, let us assume that what the consumers would like is more shirts and less shoes. If they had a free economy, the consumers would be spending more money buying shirts and less money buying shoes. Okay, what effect would that have on the profitability of shirt production versus the profitability of shoe production?
Shirts would go up.
Shoes would go down. All right, but now suppose we have a price control on shoes, shirts, and everything else, and we have generalized shortages. And now, for whatever reason, the economy increases not the production of shirts, which is what the consumers would like, but instead reduces the production of shirts and increases the production of shoes, which is not what they want. Well, will the consumers be willing to buy the shoes if we have generalized shortages? They'll buy shoes because aren't shoes better to have than unspendable paper money? You see, just think, what can you do with the with the paper money? Does it make attractive wallpaper? Does it make a good fire? What use does it have except to buy things? And if you can find something that, like shoes, having more is better than having less. You can have wear new shoes once in a while. If you find them, isn't it better to buy the shoes than to hold on to the paper money? Because you can't find the shirts that is what you want. They're not available. There's a shortage of them. There's less of them now. But if the shoes are available, won't you buy the shoes? Okay, so here we are. The consumers didn't want the shoes. They wanted the shirts. In a free market, what would have happened? In a free market, what happens if there's not enough shirts and too many shoes? The demand for and price of shirts would go up. That would raise the profitability of shirts, and the demand for and price of shoes would go down. And why would people not be buying the shoes that they don't want? Because there are other things that they do want. They can use the money to buy other things. Now, what is it that makes the funds unavailable for the shoes? Well, it's because those funds are absorbed in buying other things. And what is it that absorbs them? It's uncontrolled prices. The prices of other things have to be high enough to absorb the funds so that the funds are not available to buy things that people don't want. See, when you have general price controls, there's a surplus of funds. Funds are available to buy anything. To buy anything that has more physical utility than the useless paper money.
You just assume that people would arbitrarily just buy other things. If you take like TVs, for example, yeah. There's a shortage of certain brand of TVs,
yeah.
And you have a couple $1,000 or $1,000 that you're willing to spend on this TV,
yeah.
And now there's a shortage of them, you're not arbitrarily going to say, well, now you have $1,000, I'm just going to spend it on shoes.
Well, if there's nothing else that you can get, suppose you're having trouble finding something you like, and you now have accumulated enough cash, you would have to have accumulated enough cash so that if you do find something else that you like, you have the cash for it. But now here you are, you have cash over and above the cash that would be needed should you find things that you like. Well, why not buy more shoes? Which is more useful?
I mean, I see your point, but at the same time, just have a hard time believing someone just arbitrarily just buy things just for the sake of buying
it. It's not arbitrary, because, see, what can he do with the money? You see, we wouldn't buy it. You and I, in our normal context, wouldn't go out and suddenly buy extra shoes. Why wouldn't we? You don't need more shoes. But it still might be desirable to have more shoes. Like, do we all have all the shoes that we would like to have? I mean, how many pair of shoes do you think Donald Trump has? Or how many did Imelda Marcos have? Now, do you think that it's because we really don't want any more, or because, in fact, we have more important uses for the money? There are more of other things that we want long before that we would get more shoes. We have more important uses. But when these other things that we want more are unobtainable, and we've tried to find them, we can't find them, we have the cash available should we find them, and here we are, we have cash beyond that, and now we find shoes that would be of some benefit. See, what can we do by holding the money? Well, then we'll buy the shoes. So notice, people become willing to take more of practically anything in circumstances in which they're deprived of the opportunity of spending those funds for what it is they do want. Now, this doesn't mean there have to be larger quantities of the things they do want. Suppose people do want more of other things. If the prices of those things were not controlled, what would happen? The prices would go up, right? The prices would go up. And then when prices rose, what would that do to the availability of funds to buy things that you didn't really want all that much. Then you wouldn't have the funds to buy the shoes, because the funds that you had would be absorbed in paying higher prices for the things you wanted. But when the higher prices for the things that people want are prohibited, then what are they going to do with the funds that back up on them? They'll spend them on things of vastly lesser importance. They'll buy the shoes. So notice, people actually wanted more shirts and fewer shoes. In a free market, that's what would have happened. How would that have happened in a free market? The price and profit of shirts would have gone up if not enough shirts had been produced. The price and profit of shoes would have gone down. Those people would not be spending money to buy shoes. They would have more valuable uses for the money. They'd be spending the money possibly just bidding up the prices of other things. So shoe production would have been unprofitable. Shirt production would have been profitable. The production of shirts would have been expanded. In response to the consumer's will, the production of shoes would have been contracted. But when you have price controls and shortages, can the consumers do anything which will make shirt production more profitable? That's against the law. And at the same time, because of the shortages, a shortage even of shoes, because people will take shoes rather than nothing, does the extra production of shoes result in a reduction in the price and profitability of shoes?
No.
No. People are glad to get shoes rather than nothing. So this means that shoe production can expand at the expense of shirts, even though we really don't want more shoes. We'd rather have more shirts. You can have an expansion of production of things that consumers would prefer to have in lesser supply, and a reduction in the production of things they would prefer to have in greater supply. You could have an expansion in luxury hotel construction at the expense of the construction of vital factories and hospitals. Why not? If people can find a room in a hotel, if that's where they could spend their money, well, why not do it? See, the funds are there to buy more of virtually anything. It's utter chaos. The production of the least important goods can expand at the expense of the production of the most important goods when you have generalized universal price controls and shortages. And it's in that environment that the government steps in to say, well, no, we're not going to allow the expansion of luxury hotels. We're going to insist that the resources be concentrated in areas that we, the government officials, consider more important. Because otherwise, it's absolutely anything goes. Now, I refer to a shortage of capital and labor because the situation is that if you have the capital and the labor, it can be economically profitable in terms of dollars and cents to produce more of anything. And it doesn't matter what production must be curtailed. The curtailed industry can't rise in profitability. The price controls prevent it. The expanded industry won't fall in profitability because there's a shortage of everything, and people will buy it. So this is the shortage of capital and labor. Now, Mr. Feldman, you had a question or a comment?
It was just tied to the demand for the shoes. If the demand for the shoe was less in the free market than the demand for the shirt was higher, as the price reduced for the demand for the shoe, that would kind of even out because some would go more towards the shoe?
Well, the quantity demanded would, in order to maintain a quantity demanded of shoes equal to the supply, you'd have to lower the price.
Right.
But that means you have to sell the shoes at a lower price, and that's not profitable.
But as you did that, and the demand shifted towards the shoe...
No, the demand would not be shifting toward the shoe. See, what happens, there's a shift away from shoes to shirts.
Right.
Now, in response to that reduction in demand for shoes, in order to keep up the quantity demanded, you have to cut the price along the lower demand. The demand curve is down, and now we have a decline in price permitting a maintenance of quantity demanded along the lesser demand curve. We don't bring about a rise in demand for shoes on the basis of a fall in their price. in response to a fall in demand.
Oh, okay.
You can think of it in terms of a diagram. Here, let this be the demand for shoes. We have a reduction in the demand for shoes. Well, let's say this is the quantity of shoes produced. There's now a lesser demand. Now, to sell this quantity, we'll have to charge a price down here. But this does not serve to bring about a rise in the demand. It doesn't serve to put the demand back here. Okay, now, notice there's a significant decline in production, or the equivalent of a significant decline in production, just by virtue of malproportions in what's produced. Suppose that what people wanted was, let's say, a combination of two pair of shoes and eight shirts in a year. They would like a combination, two pairs of shoes and eight shirts. What they get is 16 shirts and no new shoes. Well, 16 shirts and no new shoes may be a combination that is equivalent to less than four new shirts and one pair of shoes. 16 shirts and no shoes may very well amount to less production than one pair of shoes with four shirts, because it's the wrong combination. You value a pair of shoes far above the last four shirts out of eight, and you're not getting it. You'd much rather have four shirts and one pair of shoes than eight and no pair of shoes. Now, it's not only that we get such malproportions in the production of consumers' goods, there will also be malproportions in the production of capital goods. When you have a situation in which any industry is capable of expanding at the expense of any other industry, well, that's a situation in which you might have an expansion in the steel industry at the expense of the coal industry. And suppose you have such an expansion in the steel industry at the expense of the coal industry that now we're mining less coal. What will that do to the ability actually to produce steel?
Reduce it.
It'll reduce it because you don't have enough coal. We've stepped up the facilities for producing steel to such an extent at the expense of the means of producing coal that because of the reduction in coal, we can't produce as much steel as we otherwise might have. Think of the potential if you simply don't have an adequate supply of ball bearings. Not ball bearings in general, but of a specific size. What sort of effect must this have on the overall ability to produce?
We wouldn't be able to repair machinery or parts.
You couldn't repair things. There are many things you just couldn't produce. So now, just consider if we have malproportions in the supply of capital goods, what's that do to our overall ability to produce?
Reduce.
It reduces it. Okay, now, when we have a reduced ability to produce, consider the fact that capital goods are themselves a product. Capital goods, machines, factories, materials, capital goods are continually being used up and wearing out in the course of production. And to maintain the supply of capital goods, we have to have a continual fresh production of capital goods. We have to use our ability to produce, not only to produce consumers' goods, but also to continually produce capital goods, enough at least to replace the capital goods being used up. Well, what has to happen to our ability to produce capital goods if the malproportion of our capital goods severely undercuts our overall ability to produce? What will happen to the supply of capital goods we're able to produce? We can't produce as many capital goods. And what happens if our ability to produce capital goods becomes less than the capital goods we've used up? Then we have a reduction in the supply of capital goods. What does that do to our ability to produce? It reduces our ability to produce, including further capital goods. And if we have continuing chaos, we may well not be able to replace the lesser supply of capital goods. So we're in a situation where we have a lesser ability to produce. We can't replace the capital goods. That reduces our ability to produce further. And we have continuing chaos and malproportions. We can't replace the lesser supply of capital goods. Where are we headed? Well, we have a cumulative, a continuing process of capital decumulation. What's happening to the productive ability of such a system? It's continually diminishing. You have a retrogressing economy, the opposite of economic progress, economic decline. This is a self-reinforcing downward process. Now, there's another closely related aspect of the same decline, a similar process of decline, and this comes about because of the labor shortage, specifically the labor shortage. There's an excess demand for labor, and we have a general labor shortage. The labor shortage exists in part because there are shortages of all of the different products that the labor can produce, so we need more labor to produce more products in every line. And also, we produce very inefficiently under such economic chaos. That requires still more labor. But then there's a further aspect coming from the shortages of consumer goods. When you have shortages of consumers' goods, and people are working, and they're accumulating money that they're unable to spend, what thought do you think might occur to them after some time? What thought might occur to you if here you were working, you're earning money that you can't spend because there's shortages of practically everything on which you'd like to spend the money?
That wouldn't be as motivated to work.
You're motivated not to work. Why not knock off for a time, live on your accumulated cash, buy whatever you're able to buy, but at least have the benefit of not having to work for a while? Well, as this thought begins to occur to people, what do you think would be the effect on the overall production of the economic system?
Decreases.
It would decrease if people start knocking off because of the shortages of consumers' goods. If they're not working, well, then less is going to be produced. The shortages of consumers' goods will be worse still. And then what if more people decide not to work because the shortages are now worse than before? There's less point in working than before. There's still less production. Well, where do you think the end result would be if this is allowed to go on?
No production.
There'd be no production. Well, what measure do you think the government might impose in order to prevent this process from getting underway? Yeah, prevent people from quitting. Make it against the law to quit a job without the permission of the government. Freeze people into their jobs. A job freeze. Well, that's what existed in the countries that had price controls and shortages in World War II. We did not get to that point in the United States, but we were within a hair's breadth of it. It was proposed by President Roosevelt in his 1944 State of the Union message. So you just think, we have a labor shortage, shortages of all kinds of consumers' goods. There were no such things as new automobiles produced from 1942 through 1945. The 1942 model year came to an end after December 7th, 1941. There was no new private civilian housing, no new major appliances produced for civilian use, shortages of red meat, even canned goods, nylon stockings, candy bars disappeared. Shortages of practically everything. And people were accumulating huge sums of cash. So they had less and less incentive to work. People certainly didn't have much incentive to get promoted, to earn still more money that they couldn't spend. And the situation was developing where people were starting to contemplate quitting their jobs. You got some strikes in the war. And you have an environment where soldiers are drafted, their lives are on the line at the front. So what attitude do you think existed toward civilian workers who would be contemplating not working, and possibly their production might jeopardize the supply of war material? Their quitting might jeopardize the supply of war material. Well, it would have the environment to make a demand to stop people from quitting, stop them from striking. And such things were proposed by President Roosevelt in his 1944 State of the Union message. But we were fortunate that there were enough people still in Congress at the time to recognize that such a measure would have the character of something appropriate to Hitler or Stalin, but not to the United States. But had we remained in the war, had the war dragged on a few years more and the shortages gotten worse, we would likely have had such controls. They existed in countries with similar institutions like Great Britain, Canada, and Australia. Now, I've already referred to the government's response to the chaos it causes through price controls, de facto socialism. It takes over every decision with respect to what can be produced in what quantity, by what methods, and what happens to it. And this is, as Mises put it, socialism on the German or Nazi pattern. Now, let me point out in this connection, the actual name of the Nazi Party. Nazi is an abbreviation for National Socialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the National Socialist German Labor Party. That was the full name of the Nazi Party. And they were actually correct to call themselves socialists, because what their system was a form of socialism. It was de facto socialism. Now, let me take a moment to deal with what countries are or have been socialist. Nazi Germany belongs in the socialist camp. Soviet Russia, its satellites, mainland China, at least until fairly recently. Then there are other countries which have often been described as socialist, which I don't think actually have been socialist, at least apart from a time when they would have had price controls. Sweden has been ruled for most of the last 70 years or so by the Social Democratic Party, whose philosophy is socialist. And most people assume that therefore Sweden has been a socialist country. And similarly, Great Britain was ruled in the years before Tony Blair took over the Labour Party. When it was ruled by the Labour Party in the past, the Labour Party had a fairly militant socialist ideology. And the same was true in Israel under its Labour Party. It had a socialist ideology. But the fact that the ruling political party of a country may have a socialist ideology is not sufficient to mark that country as a socialist country. If the country does not have the government's nationalization of the means of production, the great bulk of the means of production, and if it does not have general price and wage controls, then even though the philosophy of the ruling party may be socialist, the country is not in fact a socialist country. And in Sweden, I think on the order of 90% of the means of production were actually privately owned. In Great Britain, even under the Labour Party, the old Labour Party, back in the 1950s, still 80% of British industry was privately owned. In Israel, major portions of the economy were always privately owned. And I think the key criterion to judge whether an economy is socialist or not is, does economic activity in the economy characteristically take place on the basis of private initiative motivated by private profit, or does it take place on the basis of government orders? And if economic activity takes place on the basis of private initiative motivated by private profit, then the economy is a market economy. It's not a socialist economy. And I think that has been true in Sweden and even in Britain and Israel under their labor parties. So I would say that these countries are not, have not in fact been socialist economies. They've been market economies severely hampered market economies. That's another expression of von Mises, a hampered market economy, an economy which still is a market economy in which activity is taking place on the basis of uncontrolled market prices based on considerations of profit and loss at the initiative of private individuals and firms, not the government's orders. But the private firms are prohibited from doing many things that they otherwise would do and compelled to do many things that they otherwise would not do. That's a hampered market economy. And Sweden and Israel and Britain under the old Labour Party, they were more or less severely hampered market economies, but still market economies. The domain of socialism has been Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, the other members of the old communist bloc under communism, and the Allied countries in World War II when they had all-round wage and price controls. Now, indeed, I refer to the essential characteristic of socialism. The essential characteristic is government ownership of the means of production. That's the essential. And the essential system is the same whether government ownership is arrived at, whether either through price controls and shortages or through open nationalization. They're still both socialist. It's socialism, whether you have a Bolshevik revolution and the government nationalizes everything, or you have universal price controls and shortages, and the government simply has offices that tell all of the nominally private firms what to produce, how, in what quantities, and who to give the product to. It's socialism whether the system is established by a violent revolution or through a democratic election. It's still socialism if the government is the owner of the means of production, either openly or in fact. Now, point E is a reference to the essential economic identity between price controls and socialism, and they are essentially the same thing economically because both destroy the same thing. They both destroy the same thing. And what they're destroying is private property rights and the offshoots of private property rights, the profit motive and the price system. Now, socialism on the Bolshevik pattern destroys it very openly. When you have socialism on the German pattern, if you think of what that entails, then it's obvious that there's no private property rights there either. Yes, Mr. Levy?
What do you say, this is a broader question, but what do you say to the statement that people still view capitalism as a grand experiment?
Capitalism as a grand experiment, or socialism as a grand experiment?
Well, socialism, for all intents and purposes, more or less failed, so I guess that...
Well, I would say it's not an experiment. You know, it's no longer a novel thing, but a wider point that Mises makes is you cannot have experiments when you're dealing with the social relations of human beings. Because what is required to conduct an experiment? You can have experiments in a laboratory. When you have an experiment, you're controlling all of the elements except for one variable. Everything is the same except for one difference. And then you're seeing what further consequences emanate from this one difference. Like we can have mice, they're all treated identically in every respect except that one set is given a vitamin, the other aren't. And then we track what difference does this make. We're controlling all of the different variables. How would you do that among in an economic system?
I think it was defined in the context that I was thinking.
Pardon me?
I think it was defined in the context that I was thinking when it was being compared to socialism, in the sense that there were two systems that were kind of the outcropping.
Well, you see, there are always many things different. If you were comparing, suppose you were looking at the visible failure of one system compared to another. it would always be possible to point to certain differences. Like for many, many years, people were pointing out socialism is accomplishing much, much less than capitalism. But there would always be differences. Like they had a massive war over much of Soviet Russia. We didn't have that. And so it could be attributed to such a thing. Or there's differences in the cultures. There are ways of establishing decisive differences and a good reason for preferring one to the other, but it's not really on the basis of experiment. It's on the basis of logic, starting from certain fundamental true propositions. We can make a series of deductions and inferences. Like we've developed the laws of the price system, starting with the fact that people prefer more wealth to less, higher rates of profit to lower, how this coordinates things, why higher prices limit the quantity demanded. We have a whole system of propositions, and we're able to see how the price system operates. We can see how price controls paralyze all this. And I think we can see now that price controls and socialism are essentially the same, because both are destroying the same thing, private property rights and the profit motive. Now, how does this happen? Well, I say, I think I have a quotation. I thought, okay, here we go. I say, what makes price controls produce the chaos they do is precisely the fact that they interfere with the property rights of businessmen. They prohibit businessmen from using their capitals in the ways that would be most profitable to themselves. Now, just think about this. If price controls did not interfere with the right of businessmen to use their capitals in the most profitable way, then could price controls produce any of their chaotic effects? Try to imagine the government not interfering with a businessman's property rights and profit motive, and yet the consequences of price controls developing. I ask you to think back to the preceding chapter and recall the following elements of chaos that we saw resulting from price controls: shortages and the destruction of vital industries, the impotence of consumers accompanied by hatred between buyer and seller, the impetus to higher costs, chaos in the personal distribution of goods to consumers, chaos in the geographical distribution of goods among various local markets, chaos in the distribution of a factor of production among its various products, chaos in the distribution of capital and labor among the various industries. And I say, consider all of these elements of chaos result from just one thing: interference with a businessman's property rights and profit motive. And I go on to ask, for example, would businessmen voluntarily sell their goods too cheaply and thus cause shortages? You think that would happen? They would not voluntarily do it. And if their property rights were respected, they wouldn't have to do it, right? So would there be shortages? No. Then there would not be shortages if property rights were respected, and none of the consequences of shortages would exist. I say, obviously not. Their property rights must be violated, and they must be forced to do so, to sell their products too cheaply. Would businessmen abandon the production of vital goods if they were free to charge profitable prices for them? No, obviously not. Would they drive away customers offering them profitable business? No. Again, no. Would they run up the cost of production if those costs came out of profits, as they would have to in the absence of price controls and shortages? Clearly not. Would businessmen saturate some markets at low prices while starving others offering them higher prices? No. Would they overinvest in some industries at low profits or losses while underinvesting in other industries offering high profits? Again, the answer is no to all these questions. What makes businessmen behave in these ways is that their property rights are violated, and thus they are prevented from doing what is profitable to themselves. Well, that's what price controls prevent, and that's what socialism accomplishes too. Price controls and socialism have in common that they violate the property rights of businessmen, nullify the profit motive and the price system. Price controls and socialism are the same in that they destroy the same thing. Their identity consists in the same thing, in the fact that they are destroying the same thing. And what this means, incidentally, is you should not think of socialism as any kind of positive economic system. It's really not a positive economic system. What socialism means is the destruction of capitalism. That's what it means. It means the destruction of private ownership and the profit motive, and then the chaos that results from that. It's simply an act of destruction. It's an act of nihilism. Yes?
I think it's kind of a broader question also, but yeah. Socialism, back to kind of Mike's question, is flawed, but capitalism here is flawed too. I mean, in a socialist society, people may be, you know, hoarding their money and not be able to purchase things because there's a shortage, but what about the impoverishment of people that have no money that can, in this system, and do you
What about impoverishment?
What would improve it?
What
could improve it, and what creates it?
Okay. As a matter of fact, I have an article coming out within a very few days that addresses exactly this, and it's called Reducing Poverty by Reducing Government. And it's an answer to something that appeared on the op-ed page of the New York Times on Friday called, I forget the title of the article I'm attacking. It's in my article. It's by Bob Herbert, the article I critique. Mm-hmm. And if you don't object, I'll be happy to send you all a copy as an email attachment. I think that will answer your question.
Okay.
We have very little time left, and I can't possibly say very much. I think I've indicated that socialism is a system of economic chaos, and I'll just spend a moment or two on the political consequences of that, the tyranny of socialism. Notice first, socialism is a system in which the government owns all the means of production. Now, this means that if we were ever to have socialism, how are they going to achieve all of the means of production? How is the government going to get the ownership? Even if we had a socialist party democratically elected, we have a democratic election, what would have to be the first act of a socialist government in office if it were going to carry out socialism openly?
Take everybody's property.
They would have to confiscate all the property. They would have to resort to an enormous act of theft. There's no other way to establish it. To establish socialism by voluntary means, you'd have to wait forever before any significant number of property owners would voluntarily turn over their property. Now, I think this helps to explain why the parties, the social democratic parties like those in Sweden and Britain and Israel, why they did not actually establish socialism, even though they would have liked to. Because what would have been required would have been this massive act of theft, and then what would you expect to happen from the property owners being wiped out? You see, it's unlike nationalizing an isolated industry. If you nationalize an isolated industry, you can still pay meaningful compensation to the industry that's being nationalized. You can raise taxes a little bit on the rest of the economy. But if you're confiscating the entire economy, how do you begin to pay any compensation? And would the socialists even want to? Well, if people are going to lose their property without compensation, don't you think there might be some resistance?
Yes.
Well, then there certainly would be. How do you deal with the resistance? If you're serious about getting their property and they're going to resist, what do you have to do? You have to be prepared to resort to force. It's the very same thing in principle. Suppose you went out to some street, maybe up at Bristol Street, if there's some passerby still at this hour, and you wanted to get their wallet. And you go up to someone and you say, "Mister, give me your wallet." Well, what if he says, "Yeah, I'll break your nose if you don't get the hell out of here." What are you going to do if you're serious, if you're going to get some resistance? If you really want to get somebody's wallet, what had you better be prepared to do? Pull a gun and say, give me your wallet or I'll kill you. Well, that's what the communists do. You see, the communists are very serious about the establishment of socialism. They're armed robbers prepared to commit murder to steal everybody's property. The social democrats are not. The social democrats are a better class of people. They talk socialism. They're like pickpockets talking about the big job someday, but when they come to push to shove, they take flight and they're content with nationalizing an isolated industry, having some new regulations, so they never get around to enacting socialism. It takes the communists to enact socialism. And then once they've enacted it, and the same would apply if they've gotten through by fraud, which is the technique of the Nazis, people didn't realize what they were getting. Once they're in power, the conditions are a nightmare. We have these shortages, people in waiting lines, and there's forced labor in these systems. You have a labor shortage. In the same way the government tells the oil industry what products to produce, it tells the workers what industry they have to work in. It decides where people will work. Now, imagine a situation where people are spending hours each week waiting in line for food. You have housing shortages so acute, families have to share single rooms, and people are forced into jobs they don't like. This was the conditions of Soviet Russia. Well, people blame our president for an unemployment rate getting up 0.5% or so. How do you think we'd be feeling living in Soviet Russia, where the government has assumed responsibility for everything? It comes into office saying, we're going to make everybody's life better, we'll create prosperity for all, and you have a living nightmare. What do you think it's like to be a government official in those conditions? What do you think the potential is there to do? If people started thinking how bad their conditions are, who are the logical people responsible for these horrible conditions? The government officials. So they're sitting on a powder keg. At any moment, there can be a popular explosion to drive them to hell. And what kind of rulers does it take to stay in power in such a powder keg arrangement? You need totalitarian dictators. It takes someone like Hitler and Stalin. So no one dares utter a peep for fear of being whisked off to a concentration camp. And meanwhile, this constant hysterical propaganda to blame things on the CIA, the wreckers, foreign saboteurs, and again, there will be purges of the party itself. They'll find, well, these are the bad officials. It's their fault. They're screwing everything up. That's the nature of socialism politically. It's a totalitarian dictatorship. Okay, happy thoughts to occupy you for the rest of the week.